This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
Welcome back, Andrew. What's going on?
What's up, Chris?
Jason is in Disneyland this week.
He's skipping, dude. And this time he's got a really good reason. Like the other ones weren't that amazing, but this one's pretty good.
I mean, one of them was moving into his new house. That's pretty awesome, right?
Yeah, but there was a lead up to that. This came out of nowhere.
Well, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, one of those where we're like, okay, you will cut you some slack for going to Disneyland or, you know, something.
Yeah. Like that. The absolute last thing I would have ever guessed is that he was like waiting in line at Disney World, I guess.
Yeah. I've never been. So
I don't want to come off really negative here because I know a lot of people really do like it, but I was not a fan.
I'm not generally a fan of that kind of thing, but my sister and my fiance and, you know, people in the family are like excited about going and they've got plans to do that. And I'm like, it'll be fun if they have fun, I guess, but
yeah,
not where I want to go.
You go to Disneyland to go to Disneyland. Like you don't go to Disneyland because you want to go like on a bunch of really cool rides because you can do that many other places that are like way cheaper. Like Disneyland and Disney World are just so expensive. It's ridiculous. And all you do is sit in really long lines. And unless you pay for their fast pass, they've got the shortcuts if you want to give them even more money.
Oh, just, of course.
My mother took me because my cousin got a job there and I didn't really like it. It's too much. It's too expensive, dude. Like the entire like idea of it, everything is just so over the top.
Yeah, it's like that way on purpose. And
yeah.
It is an interesting place, I feel like. Yeah, well, I'm sure that it's kind of ideal for anybody that has kids, you know?
Like, well, yeah, exactly. Definitely paradise for that.
Overwhelming their sensations as kids, you know?
Yeah, they do have like a Buzz Lightyear shoot 'em up game, and I will say that was pretty fun.
Yeah, the like old school, you know? Disney movies and stuff will be the ones that I'll be like, yes, I know these, but most of the newer stuff I haven't watched. Oh man. So what's new in Ruby Land for you?
I am on the episode that came out today, which I guess was 2 weeks ago. We were kind of talking about that Linter action and I gave it another honest go. I just can't do it. So I have a buddy who owed me a favor and I was like, hey man, if you're willing to cash in on that favor, I need this like small PR fixed. And he went in and did that. Hopefully what I have now will fix all the open remaining issues, which I think it will. And then I'm going to release a major version and then I'm going to be like, this is done. And then just list like all the other alternatives that now exist that are way, way better.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like a good way to go. You can sit and iterate that on that for a long time, trying to appease every single person's, you know, unique case. And I think it's a good way to treat that. I really liked when DHH was like that name of person gem that they released. They're like, this is a module that we've had for like 10 years in production and we've never changed it. It's done. It does what it needs to do. And aside from like compatibility fixes or whatever for new Ruby or new Rails, the functionality is not changing. So that's it. You know, I like that. It seems like a good way to make some of that stuff sustainable, you know?
Yeah, there's better stuff out there. And I think GitHub is pivoting on that kind of area of their API specifically. Because the other day I found on the security tab now, they have code scanning alerts. And one of their examples is RuboCop. And it's actually really cool. It's basically everything we want basically out of the like checks API, or at least what I want. So, and it runs it as an action too. So I'm going to suggest some alternatives. I'm going to suggest that. And then I am going to call it a day.
Oh, neat. Yeah, I just pulled this up. Perform code scanning and watch for secrets in your private repos. This looks cool. I had been on the security tab the other day, but I read through the first couple things and was like, yeah, yeah. and didn't even notice the sign up for beta for the code scanning alerts. That's pretty cool. It's kind of like running, you know, things like Brakeman or whatever against your code. That's a nice improvement, I think.
It is. And I tweeted this out and I'm trying to find it. And I will put this in the show link, but I have a picture of the UI and it doesn't look like what you think it would. And I found it to be pretty cool. So I'm hoping people like get excited about this and then it will be totally fine that I'm abandoning this other project, because in the meantime, I made a standard RB version for these new scanning alerts.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, I've been running standard RB inside of the GitHub Actions, which is fine. But, you know, this seems like it's almost like the same thing, right? It's just a more organized way of doing that.
Well, did you see that picture I just sent you?
Yes.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, this looks nice. So are these things that you can have tied to anything, or is it just kind of like, here's the code and here's some vulnerabilities or like syntax things you've got wrong, but they're not necessarily something you can say, don't allow merging this PR or whatever, because it, you know, has these things in it.
Right. So I'm not sure. It's like very early beta, I believe. So I have no idea what they're going to do, but I like the way it looks. So
yeah, it looks like it's well organized for this stuff. It's almost just, here's the code and here's some snippets of like, this line has a note on it that says, you know, your style for this is wrong. And that is just kind of like, hey, it's a little warning, at least right now. And then you can go and address it as needed, which looks cool. So maybe long term, they'll be able to do that. You know, the problem with doing that kind of work inside of GitHub Actions is you got to go read through those logs and then actually see the output of it. And it's going to mark it as failed and stuff, but it's not going to annotate your code where this will, which is like the real nice benefit.
But it can, though. That's what my RuboCop linear action does.
Oh, okay. I've used it yet, so.
No, don't, please. I thought it was going to be a good, it still could be, but I'm done with it. But basically the checks API, what it looked to be like in the early stages of it, but it didn't really go anywhere in my opinion. But it was basically you have check suites and inside of them are check runs. And a check run could be something like running RuboCop on your code. And it annotates it in the file, kind of like Pronto, if you've ever used Pronto. Pronto is a gem that they have more for like ESLint and stuff like that, but it will like actually make code review comments failing stuff.
Like create stuff in GitHub or?
Like it leaves code review with the failing stuff. So the checks API, one of the big nice things about it though, was that there's an option to auto fix or to run an action to fix it. But it's kind of murky, I think, in the way they've described it. And the API has changed a bunch and there's not been a lot of communication. And I'm just kind of frustrated with it. But I'll link to my GitHub action and you can see on the front page, there's two pictures of what it is. So
cool. Yeah, I like the idea of an auto fix because I can add, you know, standard RB check in my CI or whatever for pull requests. But like, if it just auto ran the fix version of it, then committed those changes, that'd be kind of nice for anybody who like forgot. It would just be done for them. The thing is that they might have kind of an unexpected moment when they like go to push up another commit and it's like, this doesn't match or you got to pull down these other changes, you know? But for the most part, it sounds like they're just experimenting around that and trying to make that more of an automated process. It can never really be fully seamless. So it's got to have some user interaction in there. If you automate the fixes, then the user's got to be able to pull that down or be aware of that. And if you don't, you need to have that stuff in the UI. And yeah, it's not an easy problem. There's a lot of complexity there.
There is. But the way I would do it specifically with GitHub Actions is let's say that you're committing to my repository and you finish the feature, but I don't like the way you did the docs, or there's some failing cops or something like that, something like auto-fixable, you can set up GitHub Actions to watch for comments on PRs and issues from administrators or like people that are whatever that level of auth is in GitHub. But you could do like at RuboCop fix, and it could then kick off an action to run cops on the file, auto-correct it, and commit it. And then you could just merge it there if it's fine. They now also have code spaces, which is definitely not as nice as Gitpod. I really like Gitpod, but it's getting there for sure. So that's also going to be really nice for when, like, oh, I want to edit this code, but I don't want to go through the process of editing this code. I think it's going to make it a lot easier, or a lot more people are going to be able to like make small contributions now.
Yeah, this looks cool. Gitpod looks neat too. It looks like just VS Code in the browser almost, UI-wise.
Yeah, at least. It is. I mean, that's exactly what CodeSpaces is too.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought so. Yeah, I remember, you know, like Cloud9 came out way back when, and things have gotten so much better for working in the browser. It's pretty cool. It is practical now, somewhat, you know, to actually just develop on an iPad or whatever if you wanted, which is a cool thing to think about. All right. Anything else new this week?
I've gotten really big into testing, and I don't even really want to go into it just because I've been in the weeds, dude. I've seen the bottom of the weeds. But I do want to like specifically say that Evil Martians, number one, I literally scour everything they write and all the stuff they put out because it's all really good. So if you're not like reading the Evil Martians blog and following them on GitHub and Twitter and seeing what they're putting out, you definitely need to. But specifically, they're the ones that have TestProf. Have you ever heard of TestProf?
Yeah, I haven't looked into that in a very long time. So refresh me on it.
It's a collection of tools to analyze your test suite and basically find like the common issues and provide ways. It's a lot of it is the ability to quantify, like with flame graphs and track your factory usage and this and that. There's a bunch of stuff it does. I'm not going to list it all because it's just too much. Just link will be in the show notes. Definitely go check it out. Vladimir, I can never pronounce his last name and I've never even tried, so I always just call him Palkin.
Dementyev, I think.
I think so. Yeah, that sounds right. I just call him Palkin.
Yep, that's what everybody
knows. Probably terrible. Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like everyone's going to know if I say that. So he's got a few good talks in RubyConf and RailsConf, and they also have another really helpful resource called Terraforming Rails. And I believe that was also another RailsConf talk, but it's basically another collection of tools to help you work in legacy code bases and bring them up to now. A bunch of really like nice RuboCop like extensions and ways to like trace your gem usage and all sorts of really cool stuff. So I'm going to put both links in the show notes, and I'm not going to say anything more about it because I can't possibly explain how awesome and really helpful all this is. So definitely look and check the show notes, and you got to check it out and let them know that they put out some really cool stuff and it's super helpful.
Yeah, this TestProf looks really cool. Thing to call out here is on their homepage that Discourse used it to reduce their test suite time by 27%. And GitLab did 39% on their API test time, which is pretty impressive. So that seems like some pretty helpful tools.
Super, super cool. And it works exactly like it says. The documentation is so good, coupled with the other resources for using it. It's just so good.
Cool. Yeah, this is, you know, important stuff because you can pretty easily make mistakes in your test suites because you're like more focused on making sure the test works individually. And then all of a sudden you do that 1,000 times and your test suite takes 30 minutes, you know, and you could have made some very trivial mistakes there. And, you know, it doesn't have to be that way, but you have to be aware of those things. And most of the time, like, you're worried about your test and not the little nuances of how the test suite is actually executed. You know, like you want to cache some things as variables because you may need to reuse that across all your tests instead of setting it up every single test or whatever. Little things can make a big difference. Like it's easy to go wrong with factories or something and, you know, be creating tens or hundreds of records for every test or something all of a sudden. And you're like, why is this so slow? And it's like, well, we're spending an inordinate amount of time writing and clearing from the database. So I think that would be a super useful tool. Looks like a nice one. And if, you know, if they made a big improvement in discourse in GitLab, then I'm sure just about every big test suite could get a big improvement trying this out.
Well, and the nice thing about discourse and GitLab is they're both open source. So I read both of those apps, some of their code today. GitLab has like a list of like developer kind of rules. I was reading that and I like a lot of it. Not all of it, but I like that they took the time to do it specifically.
Yeah.
So I'll link that in the show notes too.
Huh. That's cool. I'll have to take a look at some of that stuff. I've not ever really looked. A long time ago I did, but recently I've not spent any time reading the GitLab source code at all. But that app is pretty massive. You know, they've got an insane amount of features. Like the sidebars are like packed with links for whatever features for your Kubernetes stuff, and the list goes on and on and on. And I'm like, this is insane. So they've put the investor money into some pretty powerful progress building features for trying to keep up and trying to go past GitHub and Bitbucket. You know, they're competing pretty hard.
They've got some really cool stuff.
I'm sure that they would need, you know, some way of standardizing that when they got to onboard so many developers and build all these like different features, like significantly different features, but still keep it sane. You have to do something. You have to standardize things at a certain point. And I'm sure they have their plenty of growing pains or whatever, but still, that's just being able to do that period is a tough thing.
It is, but I'm a massive fan and I've always wanted it. And it just has never come to fruition because it's a lot of work and it's dedication and it's like an entire team buying in on it. But I like to have patterns. And even if they're ones that I don't like even agree with, if I'm setting up a new app in a company, I don't want to think about what I need to add in terms of CI, deployment stuff, what our linters that we all use and agree on are, what style sheets, do we use Turbolinx? Do we use PJAX? Do we not use either? Are we doing like a Rails API? Are we using React or Vue or Stimulus, et cetera, et cetera? Like, I don't necessarily, I mean, I care about some of them, but at the end of the day, I care more about everyone having like, this is what we do, like a standard. I dream and long for it. I always have. Never gotten it though.
Yeah. When I was consulting, like that was a critical thing to being efficient as a consulting company because you're launching new stuff. And yeah, you don't want to have to reinvent the wheel every single time. You want to focus on what's this unique thing we're building for this client. And that saves a ton of time. You know, building the free and pro version of Jumpstart has saved me, even though I spent a lot of time working on Jumpstart itself. Now, building anything new, I can spin it up and you know, an hour and be well into whatever unique thing I'm trying to do. And yeah, I think that's a good thing to always be aspiring to. You want to be productive and that's a good way of keeping you productive. You got to continue maintaining those like templates or whatever, but it's a small price to pay at the end of the day, I think.
Yeah, I have a few that I use and I'm actually actively starting to like build like more of a main repo because I've always had things kind of scattered. Like at one point I forked the Jumpstart free version and renamed it because that's the first thing I do with every gem is I spend like 3 hours designing like a logo for it in Illustrator because I love doing it. It's a ton of fun. And then I spend like an hour on the code and then I'm basically done. But I'm starting to go back and try to pool these resources. Like I have some stuff that's kind of scattered and I started trying to make a gem that will have all my templates in it, or at least a way to like curl them out of GitHub or GIST or whatever, so that I can have a CLI and just be like, okay, I have a new Rails app. I want my GitHub actions I always use, or I'm in a gem. I want the gem actions I always use, and I want this and that, and I want my standard config, and I want Solargraph, and et cetera, et cetera. So I'm starting to try to build that and try to make it sort of naive and not spend a lot of time architecting it, which is definitely enticing.
Yeah, totally. I like that you were like, you spend like 3 hours on the logo and 1 hour on the code. It's a good ratio there.
Dude, it's so fun. I can get lost in it. But the whole like Jumpstart free version, those type of templates that you can build with like the Rails generators are cool, but I don't want to do that. I've already tried that. I know that it kind of sucks, honestly. So I have an app called Shotgun, and it's just a template. So you can go to the repo and hit use this template, and it will basically take the whole project over for you. And all you have to do is I put in the README. There's these two strings you need to grep for and change.
Yeah, that's for anybody that's not familiar. You can mark your repo on GitHub as a template. And similar to forking, you can create a new repo with all those files already in it. So that's super handy. I think now that GitHub Teams is free to use and I wouldn't have to pay $4 a month per member or something, I think I can move finally Jumpstart Pro from GitLab to GitHub, and then that'll make, you know, spinning up a new Jumpstart Pro app a click of a button to use from that repo, which will be nice. Before, it was like, if I'm paying $4 a month, then this is going to start costing me money to sell a license at some point, so I can't do that. But yeah, now that they've got that and the teams are free, I think it might work. So I'm going to try and use that sometime. But yeah, I agree. Like the problem with the templates are they're really finicky. If one thing fails because Spring didn't restart properly or something, then like it all blows up and you're left with this half-generated app, which is annoying. And then it's really impossible to go and add anything complex, like modifying files. You got to do a GSub on the file, and that's not great. And you're not going to get your tabbing correctly. And you just can't do quite the advanced stuff that you can do if you just create a brand new Rails app, throw it in a repo, change it there, and then just clone that every time you want to start a new app, which is what we do for Jumpstart Pro. And that is way, way easier to work with. I definitely approve of that path instead of the app generators. Maybe they will improve in the future. I think they need some more like
they need
commands or tools around them. You know, there's a handful, maybe 20 or so helper methods that are on top of Thor that Rails provides to like generate templates and whatever. Those are good, but they'll help you add a route, but they're not going to like insert this route in the right spot. They're just going to always append it at the very top. And that's not really what I wanted. I want them kind of organized in a certain way. And then you can never also tell, are there conflicting routes in the routes file? You know, you got to have a human do that for the most part, unless you load up all the routes and then programmatically do that. And then at that point, it's way overkill. So why? They don't have those features because it's too complicated. So
yeah,
I'm with you. The existing app is... The other thing with that too is if you have an existing app, you can just go to like railsdiff.org and then diff your version and the new version and then just go manually apply all those updates and you're up to Rails 6.1 or whatever, which is handy.
Yeah, I'm not doing the generator thing. It just kind of sucks. Like it definitely, you're right. It's hard to do anything complex. And at the end of the day, if it was easy, I wouldn't be like trying to automate it, you know? So I'm trying to do something complex. So yeah, highly recommend if you're thinking about doing this, if you want to do it for a gem or like a common repo pattern you set up or like your config files or a Rails app or whatever, all you have to do is go, you create the GitHub repo and then you go to settings. And I think the first thing that you should see on the page is a checkbox for making it a template app.
Mm-hmm.
Highly recommend.
Yeah, totally. speaking of new gems, Andrew Famara and I started to revive the old Mad Men gem that we were planning on building like 2 years ago. And I was planning on building something like that well before that too. But then Administrate came out. It was like 80% of what I wanted. And I tried to contribute to it and they never merged most of my stuff. And so I forked it and have been maintaining my own version that Jumpstart uses. But like, they don't support namespace models and stuff. But guess what? Active storage attachments, blobs, action mailbox, inbound emails, all of those action text, rich text, those are all namespace models. And like, they don't support that. And it's core Rails stuff. So rather than, you know, fiddling with that, you know, they can take that the direction they want. I think we're going to build our own, you know, version of something very similar to that, because I like the way that they approach it a lot, but we're going to try and re-architect it all. And I spent last night and today working on it, and we've got namespace models. We can grab all of the models that your app has, generate these like resources and the controllers and everything for you, and it'll be easy to scaffold up your own, you know, admin area or whatever. So I'm excited about that. It feels like something that probably was past my expertise level when I originally wanted to build it. Like, I would have stretched myself and learned some stuff, but I wouldn't have done it super well. And then like last night we were doing a feature in here where we need to like, so to get the folder structure clean and Railsy, I wanted to make it where we have like the subfolder where you define all of the admin stuff, app madmin resources, and then define your fields and a folder in there too. I think I just swallowed a bug.
Oh, well, I'm glad I got to see that.
Yeah, on Zoom. Yeah, gross.
Yeah, the face you made was quite unagreeable.
Yeah, when you breathe in and you like swallow a bug, you're like, what the heck was that? That's the first time I've done that on a podcast. It's a strange moment.
Yeah, and the best part is it's staying in. Final yeah, cut.
We'll leave that in. This is the reality of being, you know, a developer or whatever. I don't know.
It is, dude. We talk, I feel like we normally talk, and that's not something a lot of other shows are interviews. And when we do interviews, like it's the same thing, but when it's you, Jason, and I, like this is how we talk offline too.
Yeah. That's the thing that I wanted in my podcast was it to feel like repair programming and just hanging out, even though I'm just talking to myself. That's what I want the podcast to be like too, you know, as if the four of us or the three of us in this episode, I guess, you, me, and whoever's listening are just hanging out. That's the dream, right? Because that's what we want whenever right. We can ever come back to a conference. We want to just hang out and talk to people. Oh, yeah. The days. So anyways, back to before swallowing a fly or whatever.
Yes, back to Mad Men before things got crazy.
So last night we were working on that folder structure, and you know, Rails eager loading is what we want to make sure we're not doing anything too far outside of that, because you want these files that the user defines to be reloaded automatically. So I'm trying to stick to the Rails auto-loading structure and stuff, but you know, if you go two folders deep, you then have to use those folders with modules and stuff, and those need to match the folder names. And I was like, well, I don't want that, because that's going to make the stuff we have to define weird. And we were talking about it, and I was like, well, wait a minute. This is doable because guess what? The concerns folder doesn't require you to put a module of model or controllers over top of that, right? So it's got an exception in there somewhere in the autoloader. And so we started poking around the Rails source code, and we found there's a file in RailTies called paths, and it's the module paths. And this is like where it defines and keeps track of all of the paths and whether or not they're eager load paths, auto load once, auto load paths. All of that's just defined in this thing. And we were like, huh, that's kind of cool. And we started reading through that, and we're like, let's go see if we can figure out where it adds the concerns directory and the auto load stuff. Sure enough, we found that and we were able to figure out how to take a Rails. Well, it's an engine now. We were using a rail type before. And I don't know that, I think I've always just gone with an engine because I knew that like an engine is a more robust rail tie. And I didn't really ever
do, dude. This is an engine. I'm listening to you describe an engine, but yeah, go ahead. I'm hoping you're going to blow my mind.
Well, I didn't ever know really the difference between an engine and a rail tie, you know? And like, it turns out that I think the key difference for an engine is that if you put your app folder in your gem with an engine, that stuff is automatically auto-loaded and it works more like a mini Rails app and a Rails app. But a rail tie is just, hey, we're going to connect to the boot hooks and things, the initializers and all that stuff in your Rails app. We'll let you take care of it. So the engine builds on top of that to make it even more seamless, which is neat. So we started out with a rail tie and I switched it to an engine today, but we hook into the initializers and we set it up because Rails will freeze those load paths so you can't modify them in your initializers. So we figured out after a handful of Google searches and not knowing exactly what words to put in to describe what we're trying to do, eventually found one that was like, yeah, just use this. Make sure your initializer runs before this other one. And sure enough, we tried that and we're able to modify the load paths from our gem so that our folders in your Rails app work magically. Because there's two separate load paths too or whatever, because you have your Rails app and then your gem's in a totally different place. So it has its own separate config for the gem with its load paths. And we had to go from our gem, modify the Rails load paths, not the gem's load paths and stuff. Little things I had never done before, but like, turns out if you can figure out where it's defined in the Rails source code and then what to Google to actually apply it when you run into something like, oh, that array is frozen. Okay, that makes sense. But now how do we do it before it's frozen? You know, that sort of stuff teaches you a lot of Rails internals. And then you end up doing it the right way, which is nice because we initially were like, oh, screw it. We know we can hack it by doing this, you know, crappy version that will work, but it's not great. And a little extra research and like we can do it the right way and learn a bunch of stuff along the way. And I love those moments. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So I went deep down this path once or twice, specifically because I was trying to do stuff with Webpacker. I was trying to go the wrong way. I realized that later on. So what I was trying to do never actually made it to the real world. But I think the main thing you described earlier when you're saying basically having a rail tie versus having an engine in the, I think when you say engine, it kind of has like a connotation. Like to me, when you say engine, I immediately think, oh, you're shipping views with it. To Rails, that is the difference between being a mounted and unmounted engine in the app, I believe.
Yeah, that sounds right. Because I know that there's, when you do Rails, and it's also funny because you run the Rails plugin new command, and then you can do dash dash mountable.
Yeah.
And yeah, because the mountable one adds some extra stuff. I know that the docs include some of that, the differences. But like that one, you can add mount your gem name, add a certain route. So your gem can have its own separate routes. It isolates the namespace as well. There's some other stuff. The isolating of namespaces is interesting. You can do all of your routes are relative to the gem's routes, and then you have to call like main app.url if you want to link back to the main Rails application and stuff. So it kind of separates out your routes and things. There's a lot of interesting little nuances to that stuff. Yeah, here's a thing. Basically, engine inherits all functionality from RailTie and adds, and the it looks like there's just a lot of load paths, locales, routes, controllers, you know, that sort of assets are basically what the engine sets up, because a RailTie is like the most bare bones plugin that you can add to extend Rails. And then this is like, here, what if we like duplicate the same boot process that Rails has inside of your app and we do it in the gems folder too? And that's pretty cool. It's a neat thing. I almost always defaulted to Engine because whether or not you like take advantage of those features, you still get a rail tie. You know, you're technically doing the same thing. And yeah, you can just add those things if you want. You don't have to, but...
Yeah, I dip in and out of this and I never end up actually finishing any of it because I always get to a point where I'm like, okay, I made an assumption at some point and now that assumption has locked me into not actually what I wanted to get done. I'm pretty sure I was trying to do something with Webpacker at one point and I got Webpacker working and that is a pain, I will say. I know the docs have gotten a lot better and I know there's been a little bit more write-up about it, so I don't think it's as bad now, but back then it was a real pain. But I basically was trying to create like a mounted way to view your design system. I was trying to document the patterns we used to create our views. Some of it was components. This was at CodeFund. Some of it was components, but not a lot of it. It was mainly like, okay, when you're creating a new show page, this is what the skeleton should look like. And I basically was trying to mount that inside of like a really nice, almost like a storybook type deal. Well, the problem is that you can send stuff from the engine up to the app. You can't send stuff from the app back down to the engine without doing something that I'm not willing to do because it is the dirtiest, hackiest thing ever, but it works. But I was like, I can't in good faith deploy this also because it's brittle.
What kind of stuff were you trying to send back down?
All my like styles and stuff were defined in my application. And I just wanted the engine to render it.
Yeah. I gotcha.
In a certain way.
Yeah. Let's see. I think I've done something kind of similar to that. One cool thing is if you do a mountable, like a isolated namespace engine, it will generate the routes using your engine's routes class. But you can actually replace that and just say rails.applicationRoutes.draw and then have your engine write routes directly to the app's routes. And I think that may be how Active Storage and things do that in order to add their routes because they're not like mounted or anything in your routes file. They're like directly appended. So I would think you would be able to include your JavaScript pack tags and your style sheet pack tags in a template that's provided by your gem. But
yeah, but I was trying to get fancy. I was trying to get way too fancy because what I wanted to do is have a defined folder in the parent app that was like, I don't know, style guide, for instance. And in that, you could literally put a block of ERB and you could annotate the top of it with comments or basically like some form of like front matter. But it got all complicated because what I wanted you to be able to do is see the feature on the page and be able to like toggle to the code. But outputting ERB, like I didn't want to show like the rendered HTML. That's not useful. Like, because we were building a lot of these with helpers and like the components were coming in, et cetera, et cetera. I wanted to render that, like the ERB. And dude, ERB does not want to be freaking rendered, dude. I'm telling you, it is not fun. And I just gave up. It was just too much of a pain.
Well, that keynote at the end of RailsConf 2019 that Tenderlove talked about compiling the views and basically, you know, it's just reading that in and converting the ERB tags into like a big string that it builds up, which is super cool. But yeah, that makes it so that you have to map that like you're doing source maps in your CSS. You know, and your JavaScript and stuff, where it's like the code we wrote is not actually what's getting executed. It's different. And we need to be able to map those back and forth to each other. So that's, you know, a complicated thing to do, which is understandable. You could probably do some interesting stuff of, you know, you can look up the source location and things for methods and whatever. There's probably some creative stuff you could do there, but it won't always be accurate or whatever. It's a tricky thing. It reminds me of there's a video. So this week, Monday and Tuesday, I launched the Advanced Ruby course. Just talking about like the behind the scenes of how Rails features and other things like Rake use Ruby to do complicated stuff. This is like what we're talking about, like these meta programming aspects of building a library or a framework. You don't really write in your day-to-day code, but you do the second you get into building tools. And so that whole course is like going after that concept of what are the things in Ruby to take advantage of to build stuff like that. And one of those that I have yet to add, and I'm going to before the final release of the course, is with class eval, you can pass in a string. And this is one of the things we saw last night when we were looking in Madmin, or inside of Rails to build Madmin. Inside of the paths, they give you the ability to set things as eager load and auto load once and auto load and load path. And I found in there are these four items, and it will go in class eval, and there's a string, a multi-line string in here that defines these methods dynamically with comments and everything. And that actually defines this string because it's executing code and metaprogramming it. It actually passes in the file name and the line number so that when the stack trace runs, if there was ever an issue or anything, you know, it's able to print out, we ran this code on this line in this file. And even though it's not like a real method defined anywhere because it is metaprogrammed, you know, that is still able to tell Ruby, here's where you can find the code for this, even though it's not physically written in Ruby code anywhere, which I thought was cool. Like, that's a neat concept that you can enhance your metaprogramming stuff to give it some knowledge of where it's defined at. I thought that was cool.
So we should talk about the actual launching of the course, because I'm very interested in kind of the logistics of it. Number one, every time I see Podia, I'm like, damn, that is so, so sexy. That's some sexy software right there. So I like that. It looks like there's been really positive reviews so far. I commonly buy courses and never use them. So I literally made a blood pact with a buddy of mine, and we are setting like dates of like when we're going to be done with certain modules. So how'd the drop go? How's the reception?
Yeah, it went well. I'd never done this before, but I decided, you know, like this is a course that's pretty complicated. And so what I ended up doing was an early access launch. And, you know, that was like, I guess technically Tailwind UI is like permanently in early access available to anybody. But I thought I would do something like that and just make it early access. So if anybody like you is really excited about it and doesn't want to wait, you can get in now. And the course is not going to be like totally complete, which is like the agreement we have. It's in early access. But
right.
The benefit of that is that if you have questions and you go through this stuff and you let me know, then I can either go improve that video or add a whole new video and talk about another topic. So like one of the examples was like, I was talking about, oh, I don't remember. It's one of the first videos in the course, but I mentioned that you can alias methods in Ruby. And there's like some nuances around that. And it's not as straightforward as you think it is to alias a method. And I don't think I created a video on it yet, but I was like, I'm going to talk about it. And I mentioned that, or at least it's something you should be aware of. And so, you know, several people were like, yeah, I'd like to see that. So I, you know, went out of my way to make sure that was like the next video that I added to it. So far, like it's been going really well. Like people seem like they've learned a ton because, you know, like I was just saying that a lot of the code you write day to day is really Ruby syntax, but you're mostly writing Rails code. These are all methods that you were calling that appear to be keywords in Ruby because the optional parentheses are amazing. And you feel like you're writing Ruby, but you're really writing a lot of Rails code and stuff. And when you're writing Rails itself or Rake or any of that stuff, you're like, you don't have any of those tools at your disposal. So you really got to go back down deep into Ruby But there's so many cool things. You know, when you inherit a module or you include a class, you can hook into that and do some creative stuff. You know, so that was the goal of the course. Launching it took forever to learn all that stuff. Then it took a while to record the course. And early access went well, better than I expected. And now we're going through the process of like giving people time to go through it for the next, say, 2 or 3 weeks. And then give me feedback. I'm going to go back and redo some of the videos or whatever. Because of course, you know, I record them ideally in order, but they ended up getting out of order because I'm like, oh, I should have talked about this first. You know, there's just so much to talk about. So yeah, I mean, I haven't done a course launch since my Stripe one, like a couple years ago. And this is only my second course. So I didn't really know what to expect, but it went well. So then if anybody's interested in the course, I think I set a random start date on Podia. So I uploaded all the videos to Podia. It's been great. And basically I can set a start date. And then there's some like nuances to this because courses, as it turns out, are complicated. You can set a start date for a course and the course can be like pre-launch and you can sell the course before you can actually start taking it. And then you can collect emails and there's a lot of things you can do with it. So I need to make sure that like, if anything, if you want to go see it, you can go to courses.gorails.com and then in the footer somewhere, there should be an email sign up. If there's not, there should be one on the courses.gorails page somewhere. You'll find it. And, you know, like there was for a little while configuring like a coming soon email capture at the top. And then like when you change the state of your course to published or pre-launch and that all changes. And it's a thing where it saves me a lot of time from building the site myself, but it's also, I have to go learn that, how, what settings you got to turn on in Podia to get it to work the way you want. And sometimes you can't do that. So it's been interesting. I've definitely felt like I would prefer to have my own course software still, but I feel like it's better experience than say selling your course on Gumroad where you got to just download the videos or something. Like you get to track your progress and leave comments and all that built into the course, which is the experience I want.
Right. So I'll try to find it, but at some point I read or heard Avi talk about the fact that he did not write his own course software either because he started to and he realized that it's a pit. I mean, there's a reason that we have these smart people working at Podia because I don't want to do all this. There's so much here and it looks really good. The thing I'm most curious about is how easy was it for you to set up that subdomain to Podia off the GoRails?
That's as simple as just you enable it in Podia and then you point your DNS to their IP or whatever. And I think that's about it, honestly. I know that Andrew's worked on that feature a bit. Andrew Famara, who's working on Madmin with me, they're using Caddy, which is that web server that has Let's Encrypt built in. And so you can just say, hey, we'll listen to this domain, proxy it here, and we'll register an SSL cert automatically for you and then handle renewals and all that, which is super cool. I know at least they've looked into that. One cool thing about Caddy is it's a web server that has an API built in, so you can change the config through the API rather than writing a text file and then reloading Nginx. But I know that was like a cool feature that makes it really easy to go set that up. I've looked into doing that. And I know that, you know, anybody who's building a multi-tenant app, you're going to go build a feature like that. And then you got to add SSL to it because you have to have SSL these days. And Caddy is really the tool that makes that easy. You can do it with some, you could build, like I built a Sinatra app that would go edit the Nginx config and create Let's Encrypt certificates for an app one time. That is no fun. It's real pain to manage and you got to write all these different Nginx config files and stuff. That I do not recommend, but it is a rudimentary way of making it possible. But what seems like a simple feature is not. It's very much not.
Number one, I knew this was going to be written in Go before I saw that it was written in Go. I had the feeling.
Well, it makes sense, right? Like
it does, yeah.
Anything that's going to be proxying requests, you want the fastest language possible.
I was going to say, I learned something super cool, and this kind of ties into something I'm going to tell you at the end, but do you know why we have to add rel, no refer, and no opener on links that target blank? Or why you're supposed to?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly. It sounds familiar. I remember going through my forums and making sure that everything was no refer and no follow, because that's a perfect way for people to get spam links.
Yeah.
Because that gives you your backlinks or whatever. But
yeah
I don't remember why.
Google Lighthouse or whatever it is will call you on it. A lot of people get it through ESLint. But the reason is if you don't have no opener, no refer, I think no refer means don't send the headers, and no opener, because by default, a link with a target of blank to another site, if I am linking from my site to your site and I don't have no opener, no refer, then, and let's say I'm linking to GoRails, you now have access to my window object.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. So I learned about this on Syntax FM. So I'll link to that episode. But I was going to say you should listen to some of the Syntax FM episodes and some of the Art of Product episodes, because all of those people who are all very experienced in launching and selling courses and products and stuff, they talk about it a lot and they do specific episodes on it. And I think it would probably help you a lot if you're trying to figure out what you need to configure and stuff.
Yeah, totally. Now that we're home all the time in the pandemic, like I don't listen to podcasts like I used to. So they're just backing up on my phone and I'm like, I'll never get through all these. But I should make some deliberate attempts to go through and listen to some of that stuff. One of the guys that's really good at selling courses is that Ramit Sethi. If you've ever seen his stuff, he does like personal finance, but building your own. Like a course on your first $1,000, you know, build a product or business and sell anything to make your first $1,000. He's gone and basically his business is get people into the email list and then send them these really good emails. And then his courses can be easily $2,000 to $6,000 per course, like per person, which is crazy. So he's got like last I saw was like 20 million a year. And I bet you it's way more than that now, because that was several years ago. Just selling courses. That is a guy who knows his stuff.
That's another tier, but Wes Boss and Scott Tilinski. Scott Tilinski runs Level Up Tutorials, and Wes Boss is a JavaScript course creator. And one time me and a buddy like made like a real honest attempt to try to estimate how much money Wes made from a course, because he shows you how many people have bought the course. And then one time we bought one on pre-release. And so we knew how much it cost. And we basically calculated how much he made during pre-release, just the pre-release. Obviously going to be off a little bit, but it was boat money, dude. It was a lot of money.
Yeah, I did that one time too. And I was looking at Wes Boss's courses. I was like, look, if he sold these even for half the price it's listed at, that was several million dollars. And I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But also he has the benefit of JavaScript being the popular thing right now. You know, Rails and Ruby are still not cool right now. But I think, you know, I feel like it's stuff like this that will make it cool again. People will be able to see there's activity happening, there's new courses coming out, there's new tools like Mad Men or whatever. Those stimulus reflexes have been a big wave of interest again, and that stuff is going to come around eventually. It's just going to take some time, and we need to keep making cool things and sharing it and pushing the boundaries. Unfortunately, you know, we don't get a whole lot of updates too much on turbo links and stimulus and core stuff anymore. But maybe that'll change in the future. Maybe some other people get into Rails core team and, you know, be able to contribute and make some regular updates to those. I think that's been a little frustrating, but, you know, it is what it is. That's the whole thing about Rails has been it's an extraction from Basecamp, not like they're not running it like Laravel is, where Laravel is the business, you know, maintaining the framework. So it is a different philosophy there, but yeah. We'll get our momentum back slowly.
Yeah. Well, I am not ready to say what it is yet, but I'm working on something. I want another phrase other than make Ruby cool again, because that like kind of phrase structure has got to go. So you can help me brainstorm how we're going to make Ruby not better, not good again. I don't know. You know what? I'm just going to pretend that Ruby was never cool, and I'm just going to act like it's a new thing. I think that's going to have to be the way to go.
Yeah, it's the underground.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Check this out. It's crazy.
It's cool because nobody else is doing it.
Right. And also, yes, Rails core is not moving. I don't know. I'm not really super upset. I think I'm like mildly disappointed about the Turbolink stimulus stuff, but also now I don't need it. So I've kind of relaxed on that. There's a lot of really cool stuff going into Rails 6.1. If you haven't perused that. And also, there's a lot of really cool stuff happening in the community right now. There's a lot of like gems that I've been finding that are coming out, and I've seen some new people start writing content who have like followings, and I think this could be a renaissance. Maybe that's what it's going to be. It's going to be, we're trying to create the Ruby renaissance.
Yeah, totally. I think it's natural, you know, for any, well, heck, Mats has talked about leaving. He knows that at some point he won't be the one leading Ruby's development even. And so, yeah, people are going to come and go, and we're going to see these waves of new maintainers and new people doing the cool stuff and leading the direction forward. And yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of cool stuff going on in Rails. And there's a few good blogs that are like always publishing, like they're maintaining or keeping an eye on the commits going into master and, you know, talking about those new things. And that is fantastic. You know, we don't get maybe the volume that we used to, but I think that can come back. And you also don't need as much volume as you did back before we had no file uploads or anything like that. No rich text. We've added a ton of things in the past few years. So yeah, it's hard to know what we need for the future too. So yeah, anyways, we could probably talk about that for a whole episode on its own.
Yeah, that's a good idea for a topic. We can talk about the health of Ruby. Yeah, I don't know, dude. I see bright skies and green fields, dude. I feel it coming.
I do too.
There just needs to be like a way to showcase it.
I feel like there's been a lot more people out of boot camps and stuff that I've seen recently. And yeah, like the big boot camps are not teaching Rails and stuff as much anymore, but that's okay. That was one of the things that the like Rails survey showed. We had quite a few people who responded that had over 3 years of experience, but not a lot under. And like, we'll need to build some cool stuff to attract more people to start, but we'll get there. It just takes time.
We will get there. Big Binaries blog is the one you're talking about that releases all the updated stuff on Rails. We will link that in the show notes. All the stuff we talked about will be in the show notes. Dude, like the podcast, share the podcast, be a part of the Ruby Renaissance.
Exactly. Yeah, and go post cool things about what you're building. Go make new stuff, whatever. Do cool stuff. That's it. End of story.
Do cool stuff. All right, Chris. I'll talk to you later, my friend.
All right, see ya. I think I just swallowed a bug.